This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hey, welcome to IKEA, where even this desk is circular.
Huh. How so? Looks pretty rectangular to me.
It's because we're always looking to repair, reuse, and relove our products, like buying back your IKEA items for store credit. Or shop our as-is section for great deals. You can even order free spare parts. Get on the circular path for a more sustainable future.
Still a rectangle.
Get started at ikea-usa.com/circular. Visit ikea-usa.com/circular for as-is information and buyback and resale terms and conditions. Spare parts not available for all products.
Hey everybody, welcome to Literary Disco and Lit Hub Radio, episode 193, Being Mortal. On the episode today, we will talk about all the things human beings never want to talk about. Death, pain, sickness, and more. When we discuss Atul Gawande's seminal 2014 book, Being Mortal, Medicine, and What Matters in the End. This is Literary Disco, the last book club you'll ever need. We are Todd, Julia, and Ryder, three old friends who love to read, debate, and sometimes even agree. I am actor and filmmaker Ryder Strong. Joining me, as always, are novelist and critic Todd Goldberg and essayist and radio personality Julia Pistel. Hi, guys.
Hey! Oh, hi. Nice to see y'all. Listeners, hi. I gotta tell you something that's important. If you have ever wanted to know, is Ryder Strong Jesus? You've got to get a load of what he looks like now.
Yeah, Ryder, what conditioner do you use? Because
is it looking good?
Should we screen? Nice. Do I need to screenshot this
so no.
so listeners can see it?
You can if you want. But I haven't cut my hair since last February. It was like a month before lockdown that I had gotten a haircut. And my hair has never been this long in my life.
Put your arms out like a cross, Ryder.
No, don't do that.
No.
Although
no,
I do agree that the shirt adds to the effect.
You're taking a photo with your camera, not a screenshot. Okay.
Tech expert right. Todd Goldberg.
Having long hair turns out to be a real pain in the ass.
Yeah.
Like when you take a shower, first of all, I would wash my hair like once every 2 weeks.
What?
Like, when I had short hair.
What? Yes.
Okay, Todd, let me ask you this. You wash your hair every time you take a shower?
Every single time.
And then you put product in it after you get out of the shower?
Well, I don't put product in it every day, but like if I'm leaving the house, yeah.
Right. So guess what? You don't have to do that. If you just don't wash it for 5 days, then you're not taking out the oils that just naturally occur and then have to put oil in your hair. So you just don't wash your hair as often and you won't have to use product as often. You can still take a shower every day, but don't wash your hair every time you do.
Like,
this was a huge revelation for me.
I like watching you guys discover. Yeah, there's a whole world for you. There's a whole world for you about
anyway,
hair.
Anyway, you have to wash your hair when you have long hair. Like, every time I take a shower, I have to wash my hair now. And it's a pain in the ass. And we go through shampoo like crazy. And then just having wet hair when it's all the way down your back. Man.
Mm-hmm. Let me just go back to the whole you don't need to wash your hair thing. What about the smell? Yeah. Like,
it doesn't smell.
Todd, you've been shampoozled.
Yeah.
That's the term.
Wow.
I mean, I only wash my hair about every 3 days. Some people go a very long time.
I know Wendy doesn't.
I used to go 2 weeks.
I know Wendy doesn't wash her hair every day, but then she uses like some sort of dry shampoo or some shit also.
You're right. That I've been told since I've been complaining about having long hair, I've been told that's a thing I need to discover. But yeah, like, I mean, I have really frizzy hair. You know, anybody who watched Boy Meets World and the last time I had long hair knows I had like really crazy frizzy hair and Muppet hair. And and yeah, like, you know, it wasn't until I was in my 20s that I discovered that I didn't have to wash it and then constantly put stuff in it. I could just not wash it every, you know, 2 weeks and it'd be fine.
I don't know about this.
So
you're saying that I've fallen into the grips of big shampoo?
Big shampoo. Big shampoo.
Wait, I'm going to tell you another thing about big shampoo. This is fascinating. Shampoo should not create suds. Like, that right. is just to give you the
just
feeling.
Just to make us feel better.
Yeah. If actually good shampoo, it's just the liquid and there's no parabens and all that stuff in it. So, yeah, you all the stuff that makes us feel like we're clean is just made up by marketing. And I think the first companies to discover this was toothpaste. Toothpaste also shouldn't get all, like, foamy.
Really?
Yeah. That's marketing.
But to be clear, you're brushing your teeth every day.
I am brushing my teeth twice a day and flossing. But, like, if you get hippie toothpaste, like Tom's toothpaste, right. it yeah. just feels like you're chewing on baking soda. And that's good.
Right. Yeah, but you know what? I kind of like the gritty toothpaste.
Yeah, me too.
I feel like the gritty toothpaste is, like, getting into the nooks and crannies.
You should go back to, like, the old powder days. Like, that's what they used to do. It's like, you'd put powder in a toothbrush and, like... Yeah.
I prefer a harder powdery toothpaste than, like, you know, some sort of Crest with ribbons of color in it. Like, I don't need my toothpaste to look appealing. I just need to get in there and get, you know, the malted milk ball out of my back molar.
Wow. Well, whenever we read a really serious book, we have the most stupid conversation immediately before, so we're right on track.
I think it's appropriate. It's a little lighthearted before we
Look,
get into
Julia,
the...
Look, Julia, let me okay. just... let me tell the people here what I'm going through before we discuss this book. I've spent the last... We're late with this episode for a very specific reason. I've spent the last 12 days with jet engine fans blowing in my house 24 hours a day to dry a leak. So I'm a little on edge, Julia.
Okay, so I will own that I suggested this book about death and dying. Good Although Lord. Ryder was also reading it.
I had already started it and kind of put it aside, which I think is what a lot of people probably do with this book.
But yeah, I've been trying to read a lot of science nonfiction this year. That's like my little side book project. And this was on the list, so I suggested it. And yeah, let's get into it. Anybody want to summarize?
You're going to die. Period. Hey, Literary Disco listeners, this is Todd. If you're like me, you might be getting a little tired of having the same old meals using the same old ingredients. Or maybe, after over a year inside your house, you've just gotten back from the doctor for the first time and found that you need to significantly reduce the number of carbs you're eating. Well, you're in luck because we just started getting Green Chef at my house and it is absolutely fantastic. Green Chef is the first ever keto meal kit on the market. It makes sticking to a low-carb lifestyle easy, with recipes averaging only 14 net carbs each. Green Chef is also the first USDA-certified organic meal kit company, which means you get to enjoy clean ingredients you can trust, seasonally sourced for peak freshness. So at my house, it's just me and my wife, Wendy. And Wendy is a vegetarian, and I eat like a 14-year-old boy. So that means sometimes we don't get to share meals together, and that's something we like to do. And that's what makes Green Chef so great, because they have a lot of meals that are right for everybody. Now, fortunately, Wendy is a vegetarian, but she eats shellfish. And so this week, we got the blackened shrimp with aioli, which comes with sautéed collard greens, bell pepper, celery, and pecans. It takes 25 minutes to cook and prepare, and it is absolutely fantastic. You know, the whole process for us this week, there was a knock on the door, the dog went crazy, there was a box of food sitting out there, I opened it up, I started cooking, and in less than 30 minutes, I was fully stuffed with all of my serving and most of Wendy's. So we want to share this great meal kit company with you, and so we've got a special offer for Literary Disco listeners. If you go to greenchef.com/90disco and use the code 90disco, you'll get $90 off and free shipping. That's right. Go to greenchef.com/90disco and use the code 90disco to get $90 off, including free shipping. We think you're just going to love it. We sure have. And invite me over if you can't finish. I'm always down to help you with the blackened shrimp. Green Chef. It's the number one meal kit for eating well.
Yeah, well, I mean, I can Atul Gawande is he's a surgeon and a writer who's had a remarkable career in I mean, both as a surgeon and as a journalist. He's a professor at the Harvard Medical School. He's known as a speaker. He has like a really famous TED Talks. He's won numerous awards. He's published a bunch of books, including Better, A Surgeon's Notes on Performance, and The Checklist Manifesto, How to Get Things Right. But I think this is his most famous book. I it's funny, like I had a friend recommend this book to me after her mom died, because she found this book very, you know, soothing. And so I picked it up probably a year ago and started it, but I did find it really hard to, I got the general gist from the introduction, and I didn't end up finishing it until Julia, you mentioned it, and I said, oh yeah, I've been wanting to finish that, and I'm glad I did, but
it's hard.
It's hard. It's hard to pick up a book. I mean, it's all about death. It's all about death and old age. It's like the things that we are most scared of.
Yeah. So it's nonfiction essays. Oh. Mm-hmm. Todd's having some kind of epiphany that he knows him or something.
Well, no, I'm going to mention another book, and I just had a moment where I was like, oh, I wonder if this person wrote or knows about this other person, and they do. I'm sorry, that is great radio, folks.
Great radio. Great radio.
Sorry.
Anyway, nonfiction, I guess, you know, I consider him an essayist. I've read Better. That's an amazing book. And he writes essays for The New Yorker. But this all does hang together like a manifesto.
Yeah.
And yeah, I would say it focuses on two things. One is assisted living and nursing homes.
Yeah.
And just being older and what quality of life means. And then the second half is about dying, hospice, and making medical decisions. Mm-hmm. In the very last days and months or hours of your life.
And it's also very personal. Life. He weaves in a lot of his own
family
stories,
stuff,
his own family stuff, but then also his case studies as being a doctor or being around other doctors and their case studies.
And you know what this book also did? When it came out in 2014, it really kicked off, I think, a larger discussion about the understanding of medical narratives in general. Yeah. But also, like, understanding empathy from the side of the doctor, which I think he shows a great deal of because he's a very thoughtful person. But where you also see the other side where it's just clinicians essentially dictating care. And so when this book came out in 2014, there wasn't this whole field of study of medical narratives. But even where I teach at UC Riverside, it's become super integrated into our medical school. We opened up a medical school, I think, in 2016, and part of what the med students do is they actually take courses with Emily Rapp Black, who has written a bunch of medical narrative books and is my friend, where she's teaching them to write about the experiences that they're having. But you're you're seeing this at medical schools a lot because Michael Ondaatje, the guy who wrote The English Patient, really sort of championed this sort of thing for his med students. In Toronto, I believe it was, and it sort of has swept slowly through. But it's just about, you know, doctors being human beings more.
Yeah, it was funny reading this book now because I remember a lot of these discussions. Do you know what I mean? Like, I remember around 2015, 2016, like, there were so many essays and conversations about how the medical industry or assisted living or hospice as a concept, you know? Like, I remember, I mean, even like in 2010, dealing, you know, my grandfather passed away and we going through that whole experience, like, the notion of hospice was still relatively, like, new. I mean, I guess it wasn't new, but accepting death or the idea of dying at home versus in a hospital, like, all those conversations I remember were so like, oh, this is a new thing. This is something that the medical,
fringe.
And now, I mean, and I think in part because of this book, they've become so much more mainstream. And it was interesting to be reading this book now in 2021, because it you know, what a lot of the things that he sort of poses as revolutionary are kind of they filter down, which is great. I mean, just goes to show the power of good writing and you know, good thinking, how it can affect the national conversation, because it's definitely, we've definitely reached that point.
Well, and also I think that there's I'm just looking for this other book that I have about this, but there's been a lot of conversation because the New Yorker specifically with him, but also with another doctor whose name eludes me at the moment, have written a lot of medical narrative stuff in the New Yorker. And then the New York Times magazine has that whole section, essentially like every other week or so, where there's like a medical mystery and they try to figure out what it is. And they really humanize it. And then they turned that series of essays in the New York Times magazine into that Netflix show where that woman, where the doctor is going around to different homes and stuff and meeting with people with these hard to diagnose diseases and essentially giving them the attention that they deserve. And of course, more often than not, the people with the diseases that you can't figure out are women because doctors don't listen to women. and so there's like this whole series of things that are coming out from around this. But, you know, the things that he talks about in here also have a lot to do with just simple dignity, you know?
Yeah.
And we're all three of us are now old enough to have experienced, unfortunately, the loss of someone that we love that's older than us. And what that process is like when you realize that it's not about curing someone. It's about waiting for them to die and trying to treat them in a palliative way so that they aren't suffering. And it's such a big part of what he talks about. There's a woman late in the book, it might even be the last chapter, who essentially, her fear is not of dying. Her fear is of suffering. Mm-hmm. And it's just so awful and powerful and sad and difficult to work with. You're like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think that's for me, that's the most effective parts of this book, you know, because a lot of his policy discussions and sort of, you know, assessments of old age or assisted living facilities and aged care, like it did feel a little dated, you know, because I feel like those discussions have, you know, the policies have been changing and, you know, I mean, it's sort of timeless that it's always going to be an issue and we always want to avoid it. But I do think that like the most powerful parts of this book are almost philosophical, mm-hmm. right? It's this like broader discussion of how do we confront these issues,
right.
And how do we as individuals confront it? How do we as families confront it? And that is just amazing. Like I think that it's really I said the word earlier, I said it in relation to my friend. It's a soothing book in that regard, and that it sort of invites you into the darkest, scariest part of yourself, right? Fear of death, fear of old age, fear of dementia. And by taking a sort of unflinching look at it and examining it from so many different angles, I don't know, like you do end up feeling better. I mean, I felt better by the end of the book. I was like, you know, I'm a little more comfortable with these areas now and thinking about it. And you know, basically, you're never going to really feel super comfortable. But I guess, you know, like for me, the best part of the book is when he reaches that whole peak end conversation. Do you guys remember this?
Yeah.
Where he discusses how we, you know, there's been studies about how people recognize pain.
I love this.
Or discomfort after an experience. Right. And they basically record the peak, like when it is the worst, which might only have lasted for a second or could have lasted 30 minutes in the course of an hour of an experiment. But they remember the peak of their the painful experience and then the end of it, whether it was a positive or negative ending to a certain period of time. And like what that means basically is like if you're having a procedure done, if it ends positively, you actually remember the whole thing more positively.
Right. If you have 2 minutes without pain at the end, you're like, oh, that wasn't so bad.
Yeah.
Right. And that was super fascinating. Like he kind of breaks it down into like how we have a remembering self and an experiencing self. Yes. And that was so profound because I think that is just like so true. And I've never heard it put in those terms before. And here it was out of a real study about actual human, you know, pain and measuring it. And yet it's super, like, to me, that has hugely philosophical ramifications. Like, I'm going to remember that forever.
Yeah.
Like, I think about so many things that way. Yeah.
And I love that, too, because, well, my sister and I have actually talked about this for years because in a very different context, she teaches outdoor. She takes like middle schoolers into the woods on a camping trip, on like a really difficult, really, really difficult camping trip. That's her job. And she, they call it type two fun. Like you're in peak pain now. Type one fun is like you're having fun. Right. Type two right. fun is that you're in such pain now that later, after this is good and it all works out, you're gonna remember the whole thing like it was incredible.
Yes, right. That is yeah. So and, well yes. put. I yeah. love that. I'm and, totally using yes. that with my son.
Yeah. So whenever
it's type two fun,
whenever something is awful, she'll just right. mutter like, "This is type two fun. This is type two fun."
Right. So great. It's so good.
I love it.
But yeah. I what I really liked about
it's like graduate school was type two fun.
Exactly. So much of life is type two yeah. fun.
2007.
What I really love though about that study that you're describing, Ryder, is like he honors both. Like we have to control right. the peak pain. The controlling the right. peak pain is important. And think about the end. It's not an either or. It's not like a debate, which is more important. But you can affect the whole experience by focusing on both or figuring out one or the other if they're really causing yeah. the right. most trouble.
Yeah. And, you know, that's a fascinating part of it because of the patient is involved with the experience itself. And it reminds me of something in another medical book that I read about veterinarians. Susie Fincham Gray's book about veterinarians and how for vets, the vet is both the doctor and the patient. So when a vet is talking to you about your sick cat or your sick dog, they are telling you the treatment and they are explaining to you how your dog or cat feels, right?
Right.
And whoa. Like, and it's like that whoa. Ability to do that though is that bridge of empathy yeah. to the person who owns the cat or the dog. It's the thing that's missing in most of the bedside manner of doctors, because they are talking to you only about the disease, not about the emotion or the physical pain of treating the disease.
Yeah. And wow, I worked at a vet. That was one of my first jobs. I was basically mm-hmm. like a janitor at a small vet practice, which was an incredible experience, but so traumatizing.
Yeah,
the level God. Of trauma was very high. But part of that was the vets. Like, vets are, they have all the training and knowledge of a doctor, but their mm-hmm. patients can't communicate at all. And they, you know, it's so emotional. Their patients die sooner than mm-hmm. a human being. And they were all just like carrying this weight of like how hard it is to be a veterinarian. So I love hearing that.
And the life and death stuff is a financial decision more often than a health decision, right?
Yeah.
Right. So that comes into play somewhat in American healthcare. And he talks about that more as it relates to like assisted living and hospice. But like, you know, you go to the vet and they say, well, it's going to be $12,000 to save your dog's life. And you're like, $12,000? Like, I've got $12,000 sitting around? Just let me make it rain for you. Yeah. But for a human, it's like that accrued cost at the end of life to keep someone alive is really dependent on what your health insurance was 20 years ago, if you've carried it forward, if you have children, and if you have children who love you. So last night I was...
Oh, and if you have a daughter, how great is that?
And if you have a daughter, like, oh my God.
That little factoid was really striking.
Yeah,
like,
what is it?
Really
if striking. You have a daughter, you live longer? Son.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, it's the idea that your care in old age is going to be significantly better if you have more children.
Yeah.
And especially a daughter. It's kind of...
not surprising to me at all. So, if you think through all the examples, who's the one who like sacrifices everything to...
Yep.
Take care of you and whatever.
Oh, we're watching it happen right now during COVID, right?
Yeah.
You see the way that women have just dropped out of the workforce because, you know, they need to stay home.
Right.
Because childcare and all the... And somebody has to do it, right? And who ends up bearing the brunt of it?
Well, you know what's funny is last night I had... So I'd finished reading the book like 10 days ago and I was like, I barely remember this. And so I had the audiobook too. And so I was listening to the audiobook again just to remember stuff. And that part came up and I was like, I actually remembered something, sadly, that Ryder had told me.
Oh no.
When you know, like 15 years ago, when Wendy and I decided we weren't going to have kids, and Ryder was like, "Oh yeah, two super smart, highly educated people should not procreate. That's a really smart decision." And then,
sorry,
it's fine. I don't hold against you anymore. But I was laying there in bed and listening to that, and I pulled my earphone out, and I said to Wendy, "Oh, I got to tell you this thing I read," and then I just heard, and Wendy's like, "Why are you telling me this?"
Yeah, I agree with Wendy.
Well, maybe you guys can like adopt adult daughter now.
Yeah, and I was like,
just be like, take care of us. Take care of us as we get older.
Our nieces better fucking love us. My Step God. Up. Yeah.
Well, no, I mean, my whole plan is to start a commune. That's like an old age commune.
Perfect.
But basically, I mean, that's, you know, one of the coolest parts of this book to me was like, you know, when he covers all the old age facilities, is that there isn't really like one answer, right? It seems like, except it, this notion of autonomy and self-determination, that seems so true to me. You know, that old people are, you know, like they become attenuated to the notion of dying, right? Yeah. Like you do actually get comfortable with the notion that your existence is not, or that you're not going to have this huge career, you know, all the things that we worry about now, right? At middle age, those things actually lessen, those anxieties lessen, but a new anxiety of just self-determination and sort of like a sense of home, that was fascinating. And I think like really, you know, I think redirects our focus from like taking care of people's bodies or like making sure that they, you know, remember to turn the stove off or, you know, all the sort of safety issues that I feel like so much of old age care is centered on, and redirects it towards like, hey, you know, do you engage with another human being in the course of your day? Do you feel like your room is your room that you can decorate? Right. Do you feel like life is sort of continuing it in some meaningful way? Like, and it's not even just like moment to moment happiness, but self-determination that like, that in the course of your life, that you can be proud of like how you spent your day. It just time and time again, his examples kept coming back to like what truly makes people at the end of their life happier is not like moment to moment comfort, but this sense of that they are in charge of it and that they get to create their own space. Like, oh my God.
That notion of dignity that I said earlier.
Yes.
I mean, look guys, when you guys vaguely remember this period of my life, like when my mom, we moved her into an assisted living facility, and it's just like the assisted living facility that they talk about in the book, where they move this woman in. She's got her own bedroom, her own kitchen, her own living room. It's a full-size apartment in this building, and the woman in the book hates it, doesn't talk to anyone, won't do anything, won't walk out of her room, you know, just starts to devolve into her own self. That's exactly how my mom was when we moved her into one of these places. And my mom, not unlike the person you're hearing talking right now, something of an ego, a bit of an extrovert, in addition to being, you know, a liar, and all these other things. But she was also quite ill. You know, she had cancer and lupus and, you know, a variety of other maladies at this point, including some mental ones. But she just hated this assisted living facility because there was this order that was imposed upon her that was not her choice. Like, dinner is served at this time. Mm-hmm. Your pills are delivered at this time. And even though it was assisted living, there was still this notion of, like, you got to follow this particular rule. And this is a woman who lived independently without even, you know, she had been divorced from my dad since 1973. You know, had a great independent life and was, you know, a society person, you know, going out and going to parties every day. And all of a sudden she's in this little prison that she views. And so it was really bad. And so finally one day I drove out there and she was angry and depressed. And there was, you know, there's just a huge social scene going in there. You go in there and it's like a fucking cruise ship. This place is beautiful. And people seemed happy. And I went up to her room and she was pissed off and she was locked in this room. And I was like, Mom, there are 300 people out there drinking white wine and having a great time. Why are you sitting in here upset? And she's like, I didn't choose to be with these people. And I said, well, here's something that you have in common. No one chose to be with these people. They're all here. And you can either choose to devolve or you can choose to try to do the things that you love to do with these different people. I know they're not your friends. I know they're not the people that you love. But you have to fall in love with some aspect of this. Otherwise, you know, why not just stop living, stop fighting, basically.
Right.
And she ended up doing that. She took it well, yeah. And she ended up sleeping with half the place.
Wow, what good advice from her son.
Yeah, I mean, she really did start to really enjoy herself there. And then because she was a little bit younger than some of the folks, she also became like the spokesperson. Like, there's too much salt. There's not enough salt. Mm-hmm. But then what happened, honestly, is that her friends died. The friends she made there died. And that cycle of loss was just too much for her. And it becomes a strange culture because as soon as someone dies, this is the sort of amusing thing, as soon as someone dies, immediately the people that are still living go to their apartment and are like, are you going to be keeping the pots? Because I'd like the pots. Are you going to keep that stove? Because I'd like that stove. Yeah. So after my mom died, we were cleaning out her place in the assisted living place. And, you know, you get your own furniture and everything there. And my mom had this little sofa that I had bought her. And we're cleaning the place out. And, like, these three little old ladies come in walkers. And they're like, well, we decided that Jan would want one of us to have that little sofa. And I was like, what is happening? They're like, you don't want to drive that all the way home. You don't want to have to get a U-Haul for that little sofa. It's adorable. You don't want a U-Haul. And I was like, I don't want a U-Haul. You're right.
Yeah. I mean, that is so interesting. Because another thing that, you know, assisted living doesn't solve that he brings up is, you know, our culture is so separated generationally. So we have these interesting stratifications that, you know, will not be solved overnight because of our entire society being built around them. Like, we're not going to suddenly go back to intergenerational households, is my point. But then you have these communities that have habits and norms like you're describing, Todd, that sound pretty nuts, but...
but they're there.
Why not?
You know?
Yeah. Take the little sofa.
That's how it ended up. I was like, take the little sofa. Whatever you want, just take. But, you know, the other side of it, though, too, for my mom in this assisted living facility, and they talk about this a bit in the book, is that she was also aware that she was in an industry.
Yeah.
You know, that we are warehousing her illness.
Yeah.
And that's hard to deal with emotionally.
Yeah.
It's a lot of shit.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, the question is, how do we integrate the elderly into our lives? I loved the example. There's one assisted living facility that he describes that is connected to a K-8 or a preschool through 8th grade school. And I was like, yeah. And I've heard about similar programs like that before, years ago. And I think that makes total sense to me, that the very young and the very old find this parallel sort of, you know, there's this need for childcare, right? Like, we need grown-ups to watch the little kids. And then there's also this need for elderly care. And in a weird way, just that social, like, we can combine those two processes and they can find each other. I don't know. I've always loved that model.
Oh yeah.
And it was cool to see that was described in this book. But yeah, I mean, you know, it's like, to me, the central thesis of this book is like, we cannot push death and age as far away from our lives as we want to.
Yeah.
And that we do so at our own peril, right? Like, as a society and as individuals, like, on a personal level, it doesn't help you to keep avoiding the specter of your own demise.
Right.
That it's actually really important to have a plan, to have communication around what you want or what you don't want, whether that's with your doctor, with your family. And it's one of those things that, you know, like, I'm facing my parents getting older, and I'm realizing, like, right, so much of my parents' anxiety from the ages of, like, 60 till now was dealing with their parents' deaths, right? And, like, there was so much struggle around what did their parents actually want? How could they provide for them? How, you know, and I just want to make sure that I don't have that same level of incommunication or lack of decision making before we get into the weeds, you know?
Yeah. Right.
You know, not only with my parents, like I'm like ready to like have a sit down conversation after reading this book with my parents about what the next 20 years are going to look like. But then also with my, you know, in my life, like already I want to start making decisions, which seems it's terrifying, right? Like I don't want to think about getting, but if you don't make those decisions now in, you know,
someone makes them for you.
Yeah. Someone makes them for you. Right. And unfortunately we don't live in a country that provides for that, right? Like we don't live in a country. I mean, we have Social Security, but obviously that's not enough. Obviously Medicare is not enough. So unless like right now, it seems like the best way to grow old and die in America is to be rich, which is awful.
Yeah.
That is horrible, but it's true. And I feel that way, right? Like I feel like the best thing I can do is save up money, which is not cool. Like, I mean, and it is true, but that's not cool. Like, I don't want that to be the only solution. And reading this book felt like a step in the direction, if not structurally, because it's such a mess, but personally, it seems like a really positive step to read a book like this and to start thinking about these things and not be afraid of them. Ooh, it's hard though.
Yeah, I think this book, I never say this, you know, I'm careful never to say this on our podcast. Like most books we read, I feel like this is really good. But if you're a person who only reads one or two books a year, you know, like maybe this isn't the one for you. I think everyone should read this book.
Yeah,
I think so too. Because, I think it should be required high school reading.
Honestly, so for me, I also, like, my parents are really open about this stuff. So we've kind of talked about it, but... And I'm sure they're listening to this and they're going to laugh. But,
hi, Mom. Hi, Dad.
Yeah. My dad used to, the side note, like every time he would take a flight, even when I was like 10, he would send my mom a letter like what to do if I die. And then he started sending them to me when I was in college.
Oh God. Jesus, but that's anyway, a lot. You're like, but Dad, anyway, you just took a commuter to Philly?
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe kind of healthy, though.
But totally. That's what I'm saying. And my mom would roll her eyes. But, you know, it's more open in my family than other families. However, if my siblings and I together read this book and then talked to my parents, like we would have very specific questions and then it takes the burden off like one particular sibling. Or, you know, we could say like, OK, if this happens, then this. Then what would you want? Or, you know, do you guys have the same plan or a different plan? You know. And I think that's why everyone should read it, because it gives a collective conversation and a collective vocabulary. I mean, it is very philosophical, as we're saying, but it's also very practical, you know, like it has.
It's hugely practical. I kept thinking it's like a self-help book that's an anti-self-help book, right? Because like so many, like this is like, I hate the self-help genre. And part of the reason is because it's always about like getting the results. Like here, you know, here's how to like live a better life so you make more money or... Get laid more often or whatever the like criteria, you know, whatever. It's always a list of like, and this book is like, look, you're probably not going to get everything you want.
Right.
Yeah. You're going to die. And you're going to get used to that idea. So start preparing for it now. Yeah. And I'm like, thank you. Like, thank you for just laying it out there. And be like, yeah, like all those like desires that I've had, you know, since a child, like what I'm going to achieve and what I'm going to accomplish. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, like no matter what, the last 20 years of your life aren't really going to be about those things.
No.
And yet we spend so much of our energy, and yet we're talking like 20 years at least, right?
Where you're, significant amount of time, yeah.
Yeah, you're literally not going to be able to run a marathon or American novel.
Walk upstairs. Or,
you know, walk upstairs. Like, I mean, it's going to come down to who do you eat breakfast with and who do you, you know, go to sleep next to, or who changes your diaper? Like that's literally like what matters those last, you know, maybe 20 years of your life. And that, like that to me is like the most practical self-help advice we could possibly get. So I'm not kidding. I think this should be required reading. I mean, obviously I don't think this would have struck home if I had read it when I was younger. I do think it's like every 40 plus year old should read this book, like immediately.
Yeah. You don't need to read this when you're 14, but when you're 42 and you go to the doctor and they're like, we need to talk about your blood sugar, that's when you buy the book.
Yeah. So I want to tell you, so this book affected my daily life pretty much immediately in a couple of different ways. You're laughing. So I have two stories. And I'll start with the one that's tougher. And I have not talked about this at all. But I did tell you guys, not on the podcast, that I had two miscarriages this year and we're trying to have another kid. And it's been like really emotional and tough. And I want to be open about that on the podcast because it's so common. And I'm sure there's other listeners out here that tears could well up in your eyes at any second. And I totally get that. But while I was reading this book, I was starting to go in for like tons of testing and stuff like that. And I really was like in the mode of like, how is this doctor talking to me? How am I being clear about what my goals are versus just do the next procedure, which with infertility or any fertility problems, like you can really get on that track. Like what's next? Right. What's the next thing? And so that was fascinating. And I happen to have a really good, really, really good doctor. And like, I suddenly understood, like, he gets this, like he's emotionally connecting and like is connected to the goal of this process. Now, like with baby stuff, it's a really clear happy ending. So it's also like the goal is not die. The goal is the opposite of die. But it was so cool to see doctors who take that time and for patients to understand, like, don't lose track of, you know, you really have to make choices here. So I thought that was really, it was a cool effect that had nothing to do with death. And then similarly, this is a much more happy story. My daughter got a splinter of glass while I was reading this book. And it was in her foot. And she's like completely fucking phobic of tweezers.
Oh, I used to be phobic of tweezers when I was a kid. And oh, my God.
She's going crazy.
Glass in your foot's worse than tweezers.
Yeah, it's true.
Jesus.
Yeah.
But no, she literally said, like, leave the glass.
Oh, my God.
She's three. She was like, leave the glass. And then she said, I'll be brave tomorrow. she's arguing and like I was getting like, you know, frustrated because I was like, I know this is just gonna take a second. Like, let me just use these freaking tweezers. Like, this is so much worse because you're so resistant. And then literally because I was reading this book, I was like, wait a second. At this point I have forgotten about her. I'm just trying to win this parenting battle.
Right.
So I was like, let me take a minute and like really think through what the goal is here. The goal is to get the glass out, not to use tweezers, aka do this tiny medical procedure. So instead, we got a big piece of duct tape and we like talked it through with her. And I was like 100% channeling Atul Gawande. Like, what are your goals? Like, Vega, our goal
trying to be
is
informational. Yes, not exactly. Just the, he talks about the two different models of doctors.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
The,
right. And I was like,
priestly.
I was like, I can't leave it all in her hands because if it's all in her hands, she's going to say, leave the glass in. Right. It's fine.
Right. And I need to get to that wedding.
But at the same time, you can't be authoritarian and be like, you're taking the glass out with these tweezers.
Exactly. So we took we pulled it out with duct tape, which was so easy. And like, I learned something that you can do that.
Yeah.
And then afterwards, she was like coming down from her absolute panic attack. And then like 10 minutes later, she just goes, Mama, you're really nice. And I was like, oh my God, this is what it feels like. Like, treating something scary or something painful, like, it doesn't have to be a battle that's win or lose. Like, actual humanity can come into play.
And then so, cut to Julia in bed. Siri, how much is med school? Med school's near Hartford.
But
Well, while we're on kids say the darndest things stories, I kept thinking about 3 months ago, I was in the woods with my son. And I forget what happened. I probably mentioned something about a tree that was dying or a plant that was dying. And then we started the death conversation. And he just, the way he phrased the question at this point, he was like, Dad, it's okay that we die, right?
Oh, boy.
And I had no idea how to answer that. Like, what do you mean? And I just kept saying, what do you mean it's okay? He's like, I mean, it's okay that we die, right? And I was like, you know, so torn because on one hand, I wanted to say, no, rage, Rage against the dying of the light. Right? Like, no, you fight. It sucks that we die. But on the other hand, I wanted to be have a very healthy sort of like, yes, it is okay that we die. It is, you know. So I kept just sort of interrogating him back, and we never settled it because I didn't know. I was like, my heart was pounding in my chest because I was like, this is the moment. Like I am imprinting in him comfort, but also like I want him to be comfortable with death, but I also want him to not be like I want him to know that it's not something good that you have to fight against it. And it was so weird. I kept thinking about that while I was reading this book. I was like, right, like I still, you know, I'm still not quite sure how to, because I'm always, you know, I'm my wife makes so much fun of me because I'm always the one that's like, when you die, you die,
right?
Like, I, you know, with my son, like I'm so straightforward about, like, I do not get, you know, I don't pull any punches. But what the way he phrased that question is, it, you know, it's okay that we die. I just didn't quite know how to answer.
Well, and also because you don't want to be like, yeah, it's okay that we die. And then he's like, well, cool, because what I was going to do is I was going to jump off that bridge.
That is not going to happen.
Or pull the wings off this fly and torture animals, right?
It's okay that we kill is different than it's okay that we die. Daddy,
well,
I've been watching the Son of Sam documentary, and I just wanted to know, it's okay what he did, right?
It's okay that he died, right?
Yes.
Yeah, oh, what an interesting question.
The dog
question,
told
though.
Him to. Like, yeah, it was just the way he phrased it paralyzed me.
Yeah.
Because if he had said, like, we die, you know, or, you know, do we die, or and I would have been like, yes, and that's it, and just, you have to accept it, you know, blah, blah, blah. But he was like, is it okay? And I was no, it's not. Amazing. It's not okay, but it's also okay. It, you know, there's no choice in the matter is basically what I said. It was like, you know, I kind of was like, it's not really up to us. We just do die.
Right.
Well, so to get back to the book too, I think, you know, it's been a relief thinking about COVID a little bit less, like 1% less since being vaccinated. But this did drive home to me something that I think is really important about COVID, which is the way that you die from COVID. On a ventilator with someone,
separated
people
from
you don't know,
from your people. Yes.
Like, oh, that is the worst. Like, that is why COVID is bad. Like, if it was a
dying
slightly different pandemic where you drifted off at home surrounded by loved ones, that would be something completely different. But
what is happening
now is exactly what we want to avoid.
Right, and it's what he talks about, like, the difference between, like, the medical industrial complex that exists now and how people used to die when we died at 57, right? So when you died at 57, you'd get consumption and you'd die at home. Now you get 36 different kinds of cancer that take a really long time to kill you, and you spend 6 months in a hospital surrounded by people you don't know in an unfamiliar place, not happy.
Being tortured, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
all for the sake of extending your life.
Right. And like that was the thing that really fucked with me is like, okay, if we know you're going to die and there's nothing we can do to prevent you from dying, what are we doing? You know, like what if you know that someone only has 6 months and those 6 months are going to be torture and filled with radiation, like what are we doing?
Yeah.
You know? And that's something actually going back to that veterinarian's book that Susie Fincham Gray wrote, where she talks about like the comparison between what we do for sick and dying animals versus what we do for sick and dying people. Sick and dying people, we torture them until they die. And sick and dying animals, we just kill them, you know? You know, I'm personally for assisted suicide, and in California it has it. I don't know if I'd want it.
That was an interesting part of this book, where, because I, you know, I've had this conversation a lot with a friend of mine who is a doctor, you know, and he had a similar opinion to Atul Gawande, because like my sort of liberal, like knee jerk reaction is to be pro assisted suicide. I've just always been that way, but he has a more nuanced point, and so does my friend that I grew up with. He's a doctor, like. That there is something to be said for fighting, for wanting to continue. That if we, because I guess you know, and I was a little confused because he references the Dutch, and he says like they may have not expended as much cultural energy towards extending life as they would have otherwise. But he doesn't quite back up with statistics. I really wish he had actually cited what he was referring to there, because I'm really curious about that, because it does see, you know, it is interesting, like on one hand, like, you know, palliative care, the sort of inevitable, the logical result of really emphasizing end of life care is that somebody should have self-determination to the point of their own death if they want it. But if we allow that too much, do we open the door for doctors and researchers and culture in general to no longer fight the good fight, right? And like keep life going as long as possible in the, you know, as many cases. And I don't know. It's super interesting to me. Like, I'm not, you know, I think people should have a right, but I don't think that necessarily means we should fall back on it.
I think
super easily.
I liked his point that it's almost like swinging the pendulum too hard the other way. Like, if we can't put him on a ventilator, I guess they could just die.
Right.
And that's so glib, and I apologize. But, you know, there is a ground that seems like
that's what half the Republican point of view was at the beginning of the pandemic. Just let them die.
Instead, like hospice nurses, Gawande argues, like hospice nurses understand that actually if you extend quality of life, quantity of life may also be extended. And that's best case scenario is you also live longer. You don't just pull the plug, as they say.
But live longer with a purpose, not just live longer to live longer. I mean, that's such the hard thing. And, you know, there's a point in the book, too, where he talks about the same woman who had hated living in the assisted living facility. She eventually just tells her son, "I'm ready to die." And then it's another, 5 months or something before she actually does. And like that notion of saying that I'm ready to die, actually having a physical component to it, is something that I believe to be true, having seen it in my own family members sometimes. Like, if you say you're ready to die, something's going to happen. That's why it's good, writer, that you did not say it's okay to die. But like that whole notion of having dominion over your own health care and the quality of your life and the quality of your existence, I think is an important part of dying that we just don't really talk enough about, and which he spends a lot of time discussing in the book.
I loved the essays that included his father's story. I mean, really intense, brave writing about his own father's decline and like the choices they made. And man, that was sad.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's always so complicated, right? I mean, that's what every one of the case studies that he dives into. It's like, you know, I mean, going back to the peak sum or the peak end example that he talks about, whenever we go through a medical experience, especially leading to death, we end up sort of oversimplifying it after the fact, right? It's like, oh, so-and-so had cancer and then they died. But the truth is that's like months of like unknown and different visits and emergency. And like when he breaks down all these cases and he goes into those details, it's exhausting. And frankly, like it's a little overwhelming. And like there are times when my eyes glazed over and I had to put the book down. But I appreciate that he walks you through how every step of the way, there was so much uncertainty for the family, including his own family with his father. But in every case he gives, it's so easy to narrativize after the fact as like a sort of simple story, right? Like they got sick and they died. But the truth is like they kind of got sick and then the doctors didn't know what was wrong. And then the mother-in-law chimed in and changed the opinion. And then they went to the, you know, it's like the story just keeps growing and changing. There is no sense of like, this is a closed, easy, narrativized system, you know, like it's all sickness is so complicated. And I think that the problem to so much of our culture, and maybe this is just a human brain thing, we tend to think of our bodies as like machines, right? It's like they just break down and we fix them up. And like, and the doctors, you go when you're broken and they fix you. And like, I feel like this book and I think the medical community in general has been moving away from that, thankfully, towards a much more holistic, sense of, you know, like take away the metaphorical thinking of like your body as a machine or as a, and to recognize that it's actually way more complex than that. It is its own thing. Like human life is something organic. The brain is organic. It's, it's so, you know, it's basically impervious to metaphor, right? Like there is no real, like it's just life. Right. It's just living, and your physical body is how you are experiencing it. So to try and engage with it on a metaphorical level is always doomed to fail.
Yeah. And now we're just talking about the book, like people who have, yeah, this is so funny. Like you're making me think in a more literary sense now. You know, this book is really straightforward, like mm-hmm. I said, you know, and I don't know how he does this. I love him as a writer because he's got that like surgical, he's a surgeon, he's got that right. surgical mindset of problem solving, but he's able to make things literary without making them metaphorical, as you say.
Yeah.
He doesn't yes. pull any of those tricks.
No. It's because he has empathy.
Yeah.
You know, and so his ability to put himself in the shoes of other people, specifically of the people that have, you know, a series of complex cancers or something, where he knows that this cancer is going to kill you in 9 months, that cancer is going to kill you in 6 years. Why are we treating the cancer that's going to kill you in 6 years?
Crucially, he also says, like, I don't know how to do this. I'm not a great doctor.
I think there's a lot to be gained, though, from simple and direct language and using other people's stories to personalize the science. And then also talking about himself and his family. All of that lets you know that he's not a cyborg. You know, mm-hmm. there's another great book called How Doctors Think by Jerome Groopman, who also writes for The New York Times or The New Yorker. And that's a very helpful one in terms of understanding how a good doctor processes it's a lot of S's information. I want to recommend one other book, too, that once you read this and then you read this book, it's an interesting experience, which is Emily Rapp Black's new book, Sanctuary, which is about the death of her child from Tay-Sachs and then the time directly after that and what it's like to have lived with a child that was doomed to die because Ronan had Tay-Sachs. Tay-Sachs kills your child within 3 years at the most. And I think Ronan lived just under 3 years. And what it's like to, you know, have people tell you that you are brave for having gone through the death of your child when all you were trying to do the entire time is just give that child some peace, and provide some comfort that it's not brave, it's human, you know? And it's an extraordinarily powerful book. It's really hard to read because it's very, very sad. But it also frames this entire discussion that we're having inside of literature and inside the history of writing about death and the aftermath of death, the feelings that the survivors have. It's maybe 200 pages long, the book, but it's a very compelling book about all these things. But it's not from the patient's point of view. It's from the person taking care of the patient's point of view. Mm-hmm. And a neat companion and also just a wonderful book by a wonderful writer.
Sounds awesome.
All right. Yeah. All right. Well, required reading, everybody. Get out there and read Being Mortal. unless you're like still in your 20s.
Yeah.
Then just chill for a little bit. But by the time you're in your 30s.
Yeah.
I would say get a hold of this book and start getting used to some of these ideas.
And I'd say, you know, your mood's going to be affected. So,
yeah. But if you're in your 20s, just find a book where it's just people taking a ton of drugs and having a ton of really risky sex.
Yeah, read that. Used to love those books, guys.
Literary Disco is produced and edited by Justin Alvarez for Lit Hub Radio. You can reach out to us directly on Twitter at Literary Disco. Happy reading, everybody. Thanks for listening. Yeah.